Blog Talk Radio. Trying to go through some of the many works that he wrote. But on the knocking of the gate in Macbeth, on the murder considered as one of the fine arts. On murder considered as one of the fine arts. Lake Reminiscences, Revolt of the Tartars, The Logic of the Political Economy, The English Mail Coach, and autobiographical sketches and selections, Grave and Gay from the writings, published and unpublished, Romances and Extravaganzas, his collected writings, his posthumous works, memorials, and so on and so forth. But he was a prolific writer, but he had a unique style, and I never forgot his work, and I have followed it some years. In fact, I have got a very old book here that of published in 1906, actually. It's some on his work. And I won't bore you anymore with the details of his life, other than that as a boy he ran away from home and didn't stay away from his folks for quite some time. Was found and later went to school. But by that time, he was actually an opium addict at a very young age, probably around 15 or 16 years old. And but he, you know, he continued to, continue. I'm trying to see here that by his own testimony, De Quincey first used opium in 1804 to relieve his neuralgia. He used it for pleasure, but no more than weekly, though, 1812. He was in 1813 that he first commenced daily usage in response to illness and his grief over the death of Wordsworth's young daughter, Catherine. In the periods of 1813 to 16 and 1817 to 19, his daily dose was very high and resulted in sufferings recounted in the final sections of his confessions. And for the rest of his life, his opium use fluctuated between extremes, and he took enormous doses in 1843. Late in 1848, he went for 61 days with none at all. And there are many theories surrounding the effects of opium on literary creation, and notably, his periods of low usage were literally unproductive. He died in Edinburgh and is buried in St. Cuthbert's Churchyard at the west end of Princes Street. And his stone is out of a section of the churchyard on a west-facing wall. It's plain and says nothing of his work. During the final decade of his life, De Quincey labored on a collected edition of his works. It was only then when De Quincey, who was a chronic procrastinator, failed to answer a few letters from his publisher that the American publisher proceeded to reprint the author's work from their original magazine appearances. And 22 volumes of De Quincey's writings were issued from 1851 to 1859. That's quite a remarkable number of work. And again, he died in 1859. I'm going to begin his essay because it's very important that we consider his work tonight, which happened to be his best work. I believe it's because it was the most honest account, you know, of his and we'll begin. begin using 1804. So he was actually 19 when he began using opium. I think that's interesting because the first time I got high was I was probably, you know, that age, but or younger. But I think everybody from the 60s probably got their first inductions of pot or acid or whatever their drug of choice may have been at that time. So it's kind of interesting to see that. But what caught my eye again to this was at the time that I read it, I was 18, and it discusses his travels and his problems and what caused him and his pleasures. And I'll begin. This was first published in the London Magazine, September 1821. It's called Confessions of an Opium, English Opium Eater, being an extract from the life of a scholar. I here present you, courteous reader, with a record of a remarkable period in my life according to my application of it. I trust that it will prove not merely an interesting record, but in a considerable degree useful and instructive. In that hope it is that I have drawn it up, and that must be my apology for breaking through that delicate and honorable reserve which for the most part restrains us from the public exposure of our own errors and infirmities. Nothing indeed is more revolting to English feelings than the spectacle of a human being obtruding on our notice his moral ulcers or scars, and tearing away that decent drapery which time or indulgent to human frailty may have drawn over them. Accordingly, the greater part of our confessions, that is, the spontaneous and extrajudicial confessions, proceed from demireps, adventurers, or swindlers, and for any such act of gratuitous self-humiliation from those who can be supposed in sympathy with the decent and self-respecting part of society, we must look at French literature, or to that part of the German which is tainted with the spurious and defective sensibility of the French. All this I feel so forcibly and so nervously that am I alive to reproach of this tendency that I have for many months hesitated about the propriety of allowing this or any part of my narrative to come before the public eye until after my death, when for many reasons the whole will be published. And it is not without an anxious review of the reasons for and against this step that I have at last concluded on taking it. Guilt and misery shrink by natural instinct from public notice, but they court privacy and solitude, and even in their choice of a grave will sometimes sequester themselves in the general population of the churchyard, as if declining to claim fellowship with the great family of man, and wishing, in the affecting language of Mr. Wordsworth, humbly to express a penitential loneliness. It is well upon the whole, and for the interest of us all, that it should be so, nor would I willingly in my own person manifest a disregard of such salutary feelings, nor an act or word do anything to weaken them. But on the one hand, as my self-accusation does amount to a confession of guilt, so on the other it is possible that if it did, the benefit resulting to others from the record of an experience purchased at so heavy a price might compensate by a vast overbalance. For any violence done to the feeling I have noticed and justify a breach of the general rule. Infirmity and misery do not, of necessity, imply guilt. They approach or recede from shades of that dark alliance. In proportion to the probable motives and prospects of the offender and the palliations known or secret of the offense, in proportion as the temptations to it were potent for the first, and the resistance of it in act or in effort was earnest to the last. For my own part, without breach of truth or modesty, I may affirm that my life has been, on the whole, the life of a philosopher. From my birth, I was made an intellectual creature. An intellectual in the highest sense, my pursuits and pleasures have been, even from my schoolboy days. If opium eating be a sensual pleasure, and if I am bound to confess that I have indulged in it to an excess not yet recorded of any other man, it is no less true that I have struggled against this fascinating enthrallment with a religious zeal, and have at length accomplished what I never yet heard attributed to any other man, have untwisted almost to its final links the accursed chain which fettered me. Such a self-conquest may reasonably be set off in counterbalance to any kind of degree of self-indulgence. Not to insist that in my case the self-conquest was unconscionable. The self-indulgence open to doubts of casuistry, according as that name shall be extended to acts aiming at the bare relief of pain, or shall be restricted to such as aim at the excitement of positive pleasure. Guilt, therefore, I do not acknowledge, and if I did, it is possible that I might still resolve on the present act of confession in consideration of the service which I may thereby render to the whole class of opium eaters. But who are they? Reader, I am sorry to say, a very numerous class indeed. Of this I became convinced some years ago by computing at that time the number of those in one small class of English society, the class of men distinguished for talents of an eminent station, who are known to me, directly or indirectly, as opium eaters, such, for instance, as the eloquent and benevolent, the late dean of Lord, Mr., the philosopher, the late undersecretary of state, who described to me the sensation which first drove him to the use of opium in the very same words as the dean of dean of blank. That he felt as though rats were gnawing and abrading the coat of his stomach. Mr. Blank and many others, hardly less known, whom it would be tedious to mention. Now, if one class, comparatively so limited, could furnish so many scores of cases, and that within the knowledge of one single inquirer, it was a natural inference that the entire population of England would furnish a proportionable number. The soundness of this interference, however, I doubted, until some facts became known to me, which satisfied me that it was not incorrect. I mentioned three respectable London druggists in widely remote quarters of London, from whom I happened lately to be purchasing small quantities of opium, assured me that the number of amateur opium eaters, as I may term them, was at that time immense, and that the difficulty of distinguishing those persons to whom habit had rendered opium necessary from such as were purchasing it with a fuel to suicide, occasioned them daily trouble with disputes. This evidence respected London only, but which will possibly surprise the reader more. Some years ago, on passing through Manchester, I was informed by several cotton manufacturers that their workpeople were rapidly getting into the practice of opium eating, so much so that on a Saturday afternoon, the counters of the druggists were stewed with pills of 1, 2, or 3 grains, and the preparation of the known demand of the evening. The immediate occasion of this practice was the lowness of wages, which at that time would not allow them to indulge in ale or spirits, and wages rising. It may be thought that this practice would cease, but as I do not readily believe that any man, having once tasted the divine luxuries of opium, will afterwards descend to the gross and mortal enjoyments of alcohol, I take it for granted. And those eat now who never ate before, and those who always ate now eat the more. And indeed, the fascinating powers of opium are admitted even by medical writers who are its greatest enemies. Thus, for instance, A. Sider, apothecary to Greenwich Hospital, in his essay on the effects of opium, published in the year 1763, when attempting to explain why Mead had not been sufficiently explicit on the properties, counteragents, and etc. of this drug, expresses himself in the following mysterious terms. He cites it in Greek, which I can't quote. But he says, perhaps he thought the subject of too delicate a nature to be made common, and as many people might then indiscriminately use it, it would take from that necessary fear and caution which would prevent their experience the extensive power of this drug, for there are many properties in it, if universally known, that would habituate the use and make it more in request with us than with Turks themselves. The result of which knowledge, he adds, must prove a general misfortune. In the necessity of this conclusion, I do not altogether concur, but upon that point I shall have occasion to speak at the close of my confessions, where I shall present the reader with a moral of my narrative. And he's justifying, of course, the use of, and you can do that today by justifying the use of marijuana. Everybody smokes it. You know, millions and billions of people smoke it, you know, and use it. So, but in this case, opium is a far more serious drug in the sense that it's far more addictive and leads to many other complications. But what his confession was, basically, was, and why it became so popular, was because he's saying what he, he's an opium eater, you know, and he loves the effect. And to this day, the best medications are opiates, you know, and of course the most addictive forms of medication are opiates. But you know, the interesting thing that he notes is that he didn't note it, but history is loaded with it, that the opium trade, you know, the most ridiculous of all cover-ups was the East India Tea Company, very little tea was exported or imported to England. Most of it was opium, right? It was the opium trade. And it was, the opium was all the lords and ladies and queens and kings all invested heavily in the East India Tea Company. you know, it's over the opium trade, you know, which is 95% of the heroin sold in the world. This comes through Afghanistan. Right? So, you know, and of course the that time of India was on. But the trade routes, in East India company were basically for narcotics, you know, that's what was coming through. That's what made England so wealthy. That's why they fought so hard to save in those areas. And it's exactly why we're there today. Right? Because, you know, a great deal of the money for our military is coming from the opium trade. You know, the drug trade. You know, it's amazing. So, anyway, in fact, I'm not getting off on this, but it was an interesting article I read a while back that stated that most of your major corporations deal with drugs because, number one, they don't have to declare any income on it, and their income is extremely lucrative, and it's what keeps them solvent. It's not their day-to-day operations. It's the info of their illegal operations. So, just so you know, this was happening back in 1821 when he published this article, and it's happening today in bigger ways. Preliminary confessions. These preliminary confessions are introductory narrative of the youthful adventures which laid the foundation of the writer's habit of opium eating in afterlife. It has been judged proper to premise for three several reasons. As for stalling that question and giving it a satisfactory answer, which else would painfully obtrude itself in the course of the opium confessions, how came any reasonable being to subject himself to such a yoke of misery, voluntarily to incur captivity so servile, and knowingly to fetter himself with such a sevenfold chain? A question which, if not somewhere plausibly resolved, could hardly fail by the indignation which we would be apt to raise against an act of wanton folly to interfere with the degree of sympathy which is necessary in any case to an author's purpose. Number two, the furnishing a key to some part of that tremendous scenery which afterwards peopled the dreams of the opium eater. And three, as creating some previous interest of a personal sort in the confessing subject, apart from the matter of the confessions, which cannot fail to render the confessions themselves more interesting. If a man whose talk is of oxen should become an opium eater, the probability is that if he is not too dull to dream at all, he will dream about oxen, whereas in the case before him, the reader will find that the opium eater boasteth himself to be a philosopher, and accordingly that the phantasmagoria of his dreams, waking or sleeping, daydreams or night dreams, is suitable to one who is in that character. For amongst the conditions which he deemed indispensable to the sustaining of any claim to the title of philosopher is not merely the possession of a superb intellect in its analytic functions, in which part of the pretensions, however, England can for some generations show but few claimants. At least, he is not aware of any known candidate for his honor who can be styled emphatically a subtle thinker. In the exception of Samuel Taylor Coleridge, and in a narrower department of thought, with the recent illustrious exception of David Ricardo, but also on such a constitution of the moral faculties as shall give him an inner eye and power of intuition for the vision and the mysteries of our human nature, that constitutions of faculties, in short, which amongst all the generations of men that from the beginning of time have deployed into life, as it were, upon this planet. Our English poets have possessed in the highest degree, and Scottish professors in the lowest. I have often been asked how I first came to be a regular opium eater, and have suffered very unjustly, in the opinion of my acquaintance, from being reputed to have brought upon myself all the sufferings which I shall have to record by a long course of indulgence in this practice, purely for the sake of creating an artificial state of pleasurable excitement. This, however, is a misrepresentation of my case. True it is that for nearly 10 years I did occasionally take opium for the sake of the exquisite pleasure it gave me, but so long as I took it with this view, I was effectively protected from all the material bad consequences by the necessity of interposing long intervals between the several acts of indulgence in order to renew the pleasurable sensations. It was not for the purpose of creating pleasure, but of mitigating pain in the severest degree, that I first began to use opium, as in an article of Daily Diet. In the 28th year of my age, a most painful affliction of the stomach, which I had first experienced about 10 years before, attacked me in great strength. This affection had originally been caused by extremities of hunger suffered in my boyish days, and during the season of hope and redundant happiness which succeeded, that is, from 18 to 24, it had slumbered for the 3 following years. It had revived at intervals, and now under unfavorable circumstances from depression of spirits, it attacked me with a violence that yielded to no remedies but opium. As the youthful sufferings which first produced that derangement of the stomach were interesting in themselves, and in the circumstances that attended them, I shall here briefly retrace them. And he's going to talk about how he got addicted, but I wanted to say that last year, when I got deathly ill, I found myself in a hospital for 2 weeks and undergone five surgeries, and I found that you know, the only thing that alleviated the pain was, of course, morphine, which they gave me plenty of, and I had a drip where I could actually give myself so much every 5 or 10 minutes, and I found that I absolutely needed it, but also it was the only thing that and some other better drugs that they had, which are also opiate based, oxycodone and others, that really, really helped to alleviate the pain. And so I could easily understand how they could get addicted. I, of course, was off that and wasn't addicted to morphine or anything, but it's very easy to become that, because there's a period of time after a number of weeks that you're on the drugs that your mind is so so far away, you know, from your day-to-day world, but you see things from a very different perspective under that morphine haze. And though morphine and opium, I believe opium is probably even more intense, you know, it's a fact, than morphine, but morphine does help, and when you're in serious pain. And let me go on. My father died when I was about 7 years old. This is from the Confessions. This is De Quincey speaking here. My father died when I was about 7 years old, left me to the care of 4 guardians. I was sent to various schools, great and small, and was very early distinguished for my classical attainments, especially for my knowledge of Greek. At 13, I wrote Greek with ease, and at 15, my command of that language was so great that I not only composed Greek verses and lyric meters, but could converse in Greek fluently and without embarrassment, an accomplishment which I have not since met with any scholar of my time, and which in my case was owing to the practice of daily reading off the newspapers into the best Greek I could furnish extempore. For the necessity of ransacking my memory and invention for all sorts of combinations of paraphrasic expressions as equivalent to modern ideas and images, relations of things, etc., gave me a compass of diction which would never have been called out by a dull translation of a moral essay. That boy, said one of my masters, pointing the attention to a stranger to me, that boy could harangue the Athenian mobs better than you and I could address an English one. He was he who honored me with his eulogy was a scholar, and a ripe and a good one, and of all my tutors was the only one whom I loved or reverenced. Unfortunately for me, and as I afterwards learned to his worthy man's great indignation, I was transferred to the care first of the blockhead, who was in a perpetual panic lest I should expose his ignorance, and finally to that of a respectable scholar at the head of a great school on an ancient foundation. This man had been appointed to his situation by a college at Oxford, and was a sound, well-built scholar, but, like most men whom I have known from that college, coarse, clumsy, and inelegant. A miserable contrast he presented in my eyes to the Etonian brilliance of my favorite master. And besides, he could not disguise from my hourly notice the poverty and meagerness of his understanding. It is a bad thing for a boy to be and to know himself far beyond his tutors, and whether in knowledge or in power of mind. And this was the case so far as regarded knowledge, at least, not with myself only, but the two boys, who jointly with myself composed the first form, were better Grecians than the headmaster, though not more elegant scholars, nor at all more accustomed to sacrifice to the graces. When I first entered, I remembered that we read Sophocles, and it was a constant matter of triumph to us, and learned, the learned triumvirate of the first form to see our Archididascalus, as he loved to be called, conning our lessons before we went up and laying a regular train with lexicons and grammar to blowing up and blasting, as it were, any difficulties we found in the choruses. And anyway, this goes on, and it talks about his how he did this and this is another reason why people are led to opium, or drugs. When you're brilliant, you find yourself, especially if you're in school, if you're really smart, you find yourself going crazy in a school situation because the teachers are so stupid. Especially in an elementary or grade or high school, thing, or even in university. It's frightening when you get into university and you find these professors are really, some of them are real morons. Then it really scares you, as a student. You say, Jesus, I'm spending money to be taught by a moron. This is not good. And this guy doesn't know what the hell he's talking about, or I don't want to learn this ridiculous stuff. Anybody can tell it's a joke, that kind of thing. So you become so aware. What happened to me is actually I guess that's why this essay or this work of his caught me so, because I was in that dilemma myself. As in my first year in college, and I had gone through a nightmare in high school, this and that, and that. I even had to go to court. I had to go to, you know, it was ridiculous. So as I progressed through the mud of public high school, the moronic mud of these teachers, I just realized that I the only thing that remedied me was drugs. and finding my own way and reading my own stuff and getting into the classics and getting into, as much as I could, everything that I could read. So that by the time I was a senior in high school, I was just taking crazy courses just to get out of them, Got A's and everything, but it was just like, geez, nothing made any sense, and they weren't teaching anything of any value, so, just get out. And then when I was forced into college by my parents, I found myself in a even worse situation where I was actually paying, taking loans out to pay for a moronic education. I said, this is not going to happen. So I managed to get out of there, through the seat of my pants, my first semester after that, and took a year or so off, and got into another college and into a liberal arts program and studied history and English and found some credible people and some challenging courses, and found myself continuing my program, my degree, and getting my degree and so on. But to make a long story short, I understand where he was at there, and how difficult it is for so many people to grind through these public school system, if you will. There are some very, very talented and brilliant teachers, even in all the schools, not all the school systems, but in many school systems. But the rare one, like he found, I was fortunate to find several, who inspired me. And, that made a lot of difference in the way I pursued my education. But anyway, I really got off the subject here. He blames his addiction, of course, to his illness, and of course to his complete boredom in school, running away from school. But I'm going to move forward. I'm not going to have time to finish this tonight, and I definitely want to pick it up where I left off next week, because it's so worth it to read this essay if you can. But unfortunately, it was written in 1821, and the English is a little bit more difficult, the grammar and so on, to read than it is today, but I've read so much from this time period that I'm hoping that in some way I can narrate it or read it with to where it makes sense and possibly comment on some of this stuff to where it works for my listeners. But it's it was one of the most important works that I had ever read. And I've been wanting to bring it up on these shows often, but for some reason I was inspired to do that tonight because of recent death. And not George Dixon, but another one that I heard of recently, a young girl who died from an overdose. I thought about it. And I thought about the use of opiates and what it is and what causes it and why people take them, and you know, and why they get addicted to them, of course. But and I thought of it brought me to De Quincey's work, and it made me think I have to. There's so much in this that should be heard and read and known by others who possibly have never read it. And I ask you to go to it. Just Google up, the Confessions of an English Opium Eater, you know, and read it. It's there. You can download the ebook right there free, and read the work. And it's a marvelous work. But he goes on. He talks about his life and how he became destitute, you know, and so on. But it was through his great rebellion, you know, that unfortunately he lost his footing there. And that happened to me as well. As I lived with them for 3 years, part of the fourth, for the undiminished kindness which they continued to show me, I believe I want to go back, but I want to go forward as well to some of the great passages. But this is going to entail next week as well, and possibly the week after. It's going to be a 2 or 3 part series to read this work. Where I left off is Mike Duke. He talks about his friends who were also Greek scholars at that time when he was in, you know, high school, if you will. I made earnest representations on the subjects to my guardians, but all to no purpose. One who was more reasonable and had more knowledge of the world than the rest lived at a distance. Two of the other three resigned all their authority into the hands of the fourth, and this fourth, with whom I had to negotiate, was a worthy man in his way, but Lahanti, obstinate and intolerant of all opposition to his will. This was his guardian. It was his guardian. He said, after a certain number of letters and personal interviews, I found that I had nothing to hope for, not even a compromise of the matter from my guardian. An unconditional submission was what he demanded, and I prepared myself, therefore, for other measures. Summer was now coming on with hasty steps, and my 17th birthday was fast approaching, and after which day I had sworn within myself that I would no longer be numbered among schoolboys. And money being what I chiefly wanted, I wrote to a woman of high rank, who, though young herself, had known me from a child, and had literally treated me with great distinction, requesting that she would lend me 5 guineas. For upward of a week, no answer came, and I was beginning to despond, when at length a servant put into my hand a double letter with a coronet on the seal. The letter was kind and obliging. The fair writer was on the seacoast, and in that way the delay had arisen. She enclosed double of what I had asked, and good-naturedly hinted that if I should never repay her, it would be absolutely ruined. It would not absolutely ruin her. So now then, I was prepared for my scheme. 10 guineas added to about two added to about two which I had remaining from my pocket money, seemed to me sufficient for an indefinite length of time, and at that happy age, if no definite boundary can be assigned to one power, the spirit of hope and pleasure make it virtually infinite. And it is so, it was so fascinating that, you know, he managed to take off, you know, at 17, run away. But it is just remark of Dr. Johnson, and what cannot often be said of his remarks, it is a very feeling one, that we never do anything consciously for the last time of things that is, which we have long been in the habit of doing without sadness of heart. The truth I felt deeply when I came to leave, a place which I did not love and where I had not been happy. And on the evening before I left, forever, I grieved with the ancient and lofty schoolrooms resounding with the evening service, performed for the last evening in my hearing, and at night, when the muster roll of names was called over and mine was, as usual, was called first, I stepped forward and, passing the headmaster, who was standing by, I bowed to him and looked earnestly in his face, thinking to myself, he is old and infirm, and in his world I shall not see him again. I was right. I never did see him again, nor ever shall. He looked at me complacently, smiled good-naturedly, returned my salutation, or rather my valedictation, and we parted, though he knew it not forever. I could not reverence him intellectually, but he had been uniformly kind to me and had allowed me many indulgences, and I grieved at the thought of the mortification I should inflict upon him. The morning came which was to launch me into the world and from which my whole succeeding life has, in many important points, taken its coloring. I lodged in the headmaster's house and had been allowed from my first entrance the indulgence of a private room, which I used both as a sleeping room and as a study. At half after three, I rose and gazed with deep emotion in the ancient towers of, dressed in earliest light and beginning to crimson with the radiant luster of a cloudless July morning. I was firm and immovable in my purpose, but yet agitated by anticipation of uncertain dangers and troubles. And if I could have foreseen the hurricane, the perfect hailstorm of affliction which soon fell upon me, well might I have been agitated. To this agitation, the deep peace of the morning presented an affecting contrast, and in some degree a medicine. Silence is more profound than that of midnight, and to me the silence of summer morning is more touching than all other silence, because that the light being broad and strong as that of the noonday at other seasons of the year, it seems to differ from perfect day chiefly because man is not yet abroad, and thus the peace of nature and the innocent creatures of God seems to be secure, indeed, only so long as the presence of man and his restless and unquiet spirit are not there to trouble its sanctity. I dressed myself, took my hat and gloves, and lingered a little in the room. For the last year and a half, this room had been my pensive citadel. Here I had read and studied through all the hours of night and through two, and though true it was that for the latter part of this time, I, who was framed for love and gentle affections, had lost my gaiety and happiness during the strife and fever of contention with my guardian. Yet on the other hand, as a boy so passionately fond of books and dedicated to intellectual pursuits, I could not fail to have enjoyed many happy hours in the midst of general dejection. I wept as I looked round on the chair, hearth, writing table, and other familiar objects, and knowing too certainly that I looked upon them for the last time. Both I write this, it is 18 years ago, and yet at this moment I see distinctly, as it yesterday, the lineaments and expression of the objects on which I fixed my parting gaze. It was a picture of the lovely which hung over the mantelpiece, that the eyes and mouth of which were so beautiful, the whole countenance so radiant in dignity divine tranquility, that I had 1,000 times laid down my pen or my book to gather consolation from it, and a devotee from his patron saint. Whilst I was yet gazing upon it in the deep tones of clock proclaimed that it was 4:00, I went up to the picture, kissed it, and then gently walked out and closed the door forever. So blended and intertwisted in this life and occasions of laughter and tears, that I cannot yet recall without smiling an incident which occurred at that night, at that time, and which had nearly put a stop to the immediate execution of my plan. I had a trunk of immense weight, for besides my clothes, I contained nearly all my library. The difficulty was to get this removed to a carrier's. My room was at an aerial elevation of the house, and what was worse, the staircase, which communicated with this angle of the building, was accessible only by a gallery, which passed the headmaster's chamber door. I was a favorite with all the servants, and knowing that any of them would screen me and act confidently, I communicated my embarrassment to a groom of the headmaster's. The groom swore he would do anything I wished, and when the time arrived, went upstairs to bring the trunk down. This I feared was beyond the strength of any one man. However, the groom was a man of Atlantean soldiers, fit to bear the weight of mightiest monarchies. It had a back as spacious as Salisbury's plain. And accordingly, he persisted in bringing down the trunk alone, whilst I stood waiting at the foot of the last flight in anxiety for the event. For some time I heard him descending with slow and firm steps, but unfortunately from his trepidation, as he drew near the dangerous quarters within a few steps of the gallery, his foot slipped, and the mighty burden falling from his shoulders gained such increase of impetus at each step of the descent that on reaching the bottom it leaped right across with a noise of 20 devils against the very bedroom door of the Archidius Kellius. My first thought was that all was lost and that my only chance for executing a retreat was to sacrifice my luggage. However, on reflection, I determined to abide the issue. And the groom was in the utmost alarm, both on his own account and on mine. But in spite of this, so irresistibly had the sense of the ludicrous and this unhappy contretemps taken possession of his fancy, that he sang out a long, loud, and canorous peal of laughter that might have wakened the 7 sleepers. At the sound of his resonant merriment, within the very ears of insulted authority, I could not myself forbear joining him. Subdued to this, not so much by the unhappy entourage of the trunk, as by the effect it had upon the groom. We both expected, as a matter of course, that Dr. Blank would sally out of his room, for in general, if but a mouse stirred, he sprang out like a mastiff from his kennel. And strange to say, however, on this occasion, when the noise of laughter had ceased, no sound or rustling even was to be heard in the bedroom. Dr. Blank had a painful complaint, which sometimes keeping him awake made his sleep perhaps, when it did come, the deeper. Gathering courage from the silence, the groom hoisted his burden again and accomplished the remains of his descent without accident. I waited until I saw the trunk placed on a wheelbarrow and on its road to the carrier. Then, with Providence, my guide, I set off on foot, carrying a small parcel with some articles of dress under my arm, a favorite English poet in one pocket, and a small 12-month volume containing about 9 plays of Euripides in the other. It's funny how you laugh, that what makes me laugh about that was the I guess it was the closeness he had to his books. I've always been that way myself. I don't know why, but I've always had so many books. And when I was 17, 18, when I left college, I had accumulated books that I wanted and that I read. And one of them, of course, was this Opium Eater Great English Literature. It was a big book on, it was an anthology of English literature. And a number of other books, but I carried those with me as much as they were uncomfortable and hard to manage sometimes. But they gave me such great comfort to read when I was hitchhiking or traveling. I did a number of bunch of hitchhiking back then. It gave me a great sense of security reading these things that put you in a different world, you know. But in a world of remarkable reality, another reality, you know. That's what reading always does. Like even this moment, as I'm talking to you and reading this, we suddenly are in De Quincey's early teen, he's 17 years old here, and we can see it. We can visualize it. I can see it. And anyone who's actually ever run away, you know, at that age, at those ages, because of intolerance and complete whatever, we can understand what De Quincey was about. At least I can. And I want to just finish this. I know we've passed the hour and we're now into a recording time here, but I just wanted to read this last paragraph. It had been my intention originally to proceed to Westmoreland, both from the love I bore to that country and on other personal accounts. Accident, however, gave a different direction to my wanderings, and I bent my step towards North Wales. After wandering about for some time in Dyfnshire, Mearnshire, and Carmarthenshire, I took lodging in a small, neat house in B, it just says B, and here I might have been stayed with great comfort for many weeks, for provisions were cheap at B. From the scarcity of other markets for the surplus produce of a wide agricultural district. An accident, however, in which perhaps no offense was designed, drove me out to wander again. I know not whether my reader may have remarked, but I have often remarked that the proudest class of people in England, or at any rate of the class whose pride is the most apparent, are the families of bishops. Noblemen and their children carry about with them in their very titles a sufficient notification of their rank, nay, their very names. And this applies also to the children of many untitled houses, or often to the English ear, adequate exponents of high birth and descent. Sackville, Manners, Fitzroy, Pollitt, Cavendish, and scores of others tell their own tale. Such persons, therefore, find themselves a due sense of their claim already established, except among those who are ignorant of the world by virtue of their own obscurity. Not to know them argues one's self unknown. Their manners are a subtle tone and coloring, and for once they find it necessary to impress a sense of their consequence upon others. They meet with a thousand occasions for moderating and tempering this sense by act of courteous condescension, or rather condescension. And with the family of bishops, it is otherwise with them. It is all uphill work to make known their pretensions, for the proportion of the episcopal branch taken from noble families is not at all times very large. And the succession of these dignitaries is so rapid that the public ear seldom has time to become familiar with them, unless where they are connected with some literary reputation. Hence it is that the children of bishops carry about with them an austere and repulsive air, indicative of claims not generally acknowledged or sort of manner, nervously apprehensive of too familiar approach, and shrinking with the sensitiveness of a gouty man from all contact with the and he puts this in Greek, and I don't know what that is. Doubtless, a powerful understanding or unusual goodness of nature will preserve a man from such weakness. But in general, the truth of my representation will be acknowledged pride, if not of deeper root in such families, appears at least more upon the surface of their manners. The spirit of manners naturally communicates itself to their domestics and other dependents. Now my landlady had been a lady's maid for a nurse in a family of the bishop of, and had been lately married away and settled, as such people expressed it, for life. And in a little town like B, really to have lived in the bishop's family conferred some distinction. And my good landlady had rather more than her share of the pride I have noticed on that score. What my lord said and what my lord did, how useful he was in Parliament and how indispensable at Oxford, formed the daily burden of her talk. All this I bore very well, for I was too good-natured to laugh in anybody's face, and I could make an ample allowance for the garrulity of an old servant. Of necessity, however, I must have appeared in her eyes very inadequately impressed with the bishop's importance, and perhaps to punish me for my indifference, or possibly by accident, she one day repeated to me a conversation in which I was indirectly a party concerned. She had been to the palace to pay her respects to the family, and dinner being over, was summoned into the dining room. In giving an account of her household economy, she happened to mention that she had let her apartments. Thereupon the good bishop, it seemed, had taken occasion to caution her as to her selection of inmates, for she said, "You must recollect, Betty, that this place is in the high road to the head, and so that multitudes of Irish swindlers running away from their debts into England, and of English swindlers running away from their debts to the Isle of Man, are likely to take this place in their route." This advice certainly was not without reasonable grounds, but rather fitted to be stored up for Mrs. Betty's private meditations when specially reported to me. What followed, however, was somewhat worse. "Oh, my lord," answered my lady, according to her own representation of the matter, "I really don't think this young gentleman is a swindler, because you don't think me a swindler," said I, interrupting her in a tumult of indignation. "For the future, I shall spare you the trouble of thinking about it." And without delay, I prepared for my departure. And some concessions the good woman seemed disposed to make, but a harsh and contemptuous expression, which I feared that I applied to the learned, dignitary herself, roused her indignation in turn, and reconciliation then became impossible. I was indeed greatly irritated at the bishop's having suggested any grounds of suspicion, however remotely, against a person whom he had never seen, and I thought of letting him know my mind in Greek, which at the same time that it would furnish some presumption that I was no swindler, would also, I hope, compel the bishop to reply in the same language, in which case I doubted not to make it appear that if I was not so rich as his lordship, I was far better a Grecian. And calmer thoughts, however, drove this boyish design out of my mind, for I considered that the bishop was in the right to counsel an old servant, that he could not have designed that his advice would be reported to me, and that the same coarseness of mind which had led Miss Betty, to repeat the advice at all, might have colored it in a way more agreeable to her own style of thinking and to the actual expression of the worthy bishop. Now, I'm going to stop there, and you can see the humor in this tale. And you can understand the degree that he you can see how he thinks, you know. And we will I guess we'll continue from there next week. I've got too much to do here before I get to part two. And there's too much more to read. But I hope you enjoyed that. I really enjoyed talking about it and reading it. And next week we'll start where we left off on his where he takes off from this house, you know, and continues on his journey. So I want to thank everybody who joined me tonight, and I hope you join me next week when I continue this. And hope you have a great weekend. And don't forget, if you can check out De Quincey's Confession of an English Hopi Meter. Just go to Google and look it up, and you'll see it's a, I can't tell you what website it is. It's just in there, just Confessions of an English Hopi Meter by Thomas De Quincey. And you'll see there there'll be, you Google it, and you'll see this Start Project Gutenberg ebook, Confessions. Gutenberg ebook, Confessions of an Opium Eater. Okay, check that out. Okay, again. G-U-T-E-N-B-E-R-G ebook, Confessions of an English Opium Eater. Right? And you'll find that Project Gutenberg ebook, Confessions of an English Opium Eater by Thomas De Quincey. Okay? And you can download the book at no cost and read it and come back with me next week, and we can discuss it later, or read along with me next week. So I wish you all a good night, and I want to thank everybody who joined me. And we hope you have a great weekend. The weather's supposed to be great this weekend.